Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years after Jane Goodall began her research in Tanzania and made the world care about chimpanzees because they were so much like us, a new inquiry says true, but let's look at the differences. They tell an amazing story, too, and maybe just what made us human. Science magazine reporter John Cohen tells the story. And we'll hear from writer Sarah Gruen, whose novel Water for Elephants was a big bestseller. She's out with her next. It's called Ape House. This hour on Point, John Cohen on chimps and humans, Sarah Gruen on Ape House. You can join the conversation. Have you watched chimpanzees and wondered just how close we really are? What about the critical differences? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Oh, there they are now. A little chimp sound right there, and it's wild in a hurry. Joining me first this hour from San Diego, California, is John Cohen, correspondent for Science Magazine. His new book is Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforests, Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. John Cohen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you say right off the bat that you are not a researcher yourself, and yet you set out with kind of a big mission here. What is it, John?
Well, the thing that fascinated me from the outset is how the chimpanzee genome in 2005 was finally sequenced, and we had this ability to see human and chimps through a new lens, if you will. And then that just opened up a whole flood of ideas for me about human and chimp differences.
Our thinking about chimps, if you go back, I don't know, a century or two, was pretty rough, pretty disparaging. If you go back to the 1920s and then again in the 1960s, we got a big impetus once and then again to look at chimpanzees and see how much of ourselves was there. Tell us about where that sense, which an awful lot of people have now, where that came from.
Well, if you go back to, and this seems kind of astonishing to us now, but if you go back to even like the 1920s, people had a great fear of chimpanzees, and there was a notion that they were the invention of the devil. And they were a cornerstone to the Darwinian argument of evolution. And at the time of the Scopes trial, there was a book written called Almost Human by Robert Yerkes, who advocated that we study chimpanzees to learn about ourselves. And then come 1960 and Jane Goodall, the notion that we could observe them up close in the wild and really get a sense of what their communities were like opened up this whole new idea of chimpanzee conservation, and Jane Goodall spearheaded that. And humans started to not just see chimpanzees as something to learn from, but to want to protect them as well.
Almost Human was the great famous book in the 1920s that precedes yours, Almost Chimpanzee. Tell us about Almost Human.
Well, Almost Human came out at the time of the Scopes trial. And at the Scopes trial, people brought chimpanzees to the town to either argue for or against evolution. And Yerkes, who was a psychologist, believed that if we studied chimpanzees, maybe we could learn how to better educate our own children, and believed that we could do biomedical research with them, a little bit of which had started to happen, but not very much. And he, in fact, started the first colony of research chimpanzees in the United States, which still exists today in Atlanta, and it's called the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. So he really sparked this whole idea of using chimpanzees in research.
And then comes Jane Goodall in the 1960s, a very appealing character, deep in sort of the chimpanzee zone there in Tanzania, who gained worldwide fame for her work with these animals and the great intimacy and respect she gave them, the notion of communication with chimps.
Yeah, it was interesting because there had been people prior to Jane Goodall who had studied wild chimpanzees, but no one had really done it systematically and for a long term. And then she comes along and habituates the chimpanzees to her, which means that they allowed her to follow them around. And Jane Goodall and the team of people who then soon joined her were able to see all sorts of things that nobody knew about them. And one of the first big observations was that they indeed did use tools. That used to be seen as a dividing line between humans and chimpanzees. Subsequently, today, there are maybe a dozen sites around the world that do long-term studies of chimpanzees and their close relatives of bonobos.
We'll talk something about those. Here's a little bit from a documentary film with Jane Goodall herself and her group recently celebrating a 50th anniversary of its work. Here she is in the documentary talking about, this is just one example, the strong connection between the chimpanzee Lucy and the people who raised her.
She arrived in the Gambia. She was put in a large field enclosure with a couple of rather boisterous wild-born chimps from Burundi. And she went into deep depression, which lasted for at least 2 years, trying to avoid the approaches of these two creatures who she didn't know at all. And just around this time, she was visited by someone who had known her in the old days when she was part of a family. At that time, Lucy had been taught, I don't know, somewhere between 60 and 100 signs of the American Sign Language. And when she saw this visitor, she ran over to the wire of her enclosure. And she looked into her eyes and she said, "Please help out."
Jane Goodall, who said, who told us that chimpanzees use tools, use language, make war, and was very, very effective in that. What's your message, John? Are you trying to say no, we're not connected to these great apes, or something?
Well, I'm not certain. I'm not certain that Jane Goodall said they use language, and that's a very hot debated point. They communicate with each other clearly. But language is something else, and that's one of the things that I explore in great detail. Chimpanzees certainly have the ability to let each other know emotions and thoughts to some degree.
I mean, heard Jane saying here that Lucy had 60-plus sign language signs, and she ran gate to the wire and said, "Please help out."
Right. Lucy was an enculturated chimp raised in a human home mm-hmm. that was then later returned to Africa. Mm-hmm. And Lucy was taught by humans American Sign Language. What's interesting about chimpanzees and bonobos that learn how to communicate with humans is they all kind of hit the wall at a few hundred words. The average high school student has about a vocabulary of about 60,000 words. And we also have the ability to embed thoughts. A human can I can have a sentence where I change shift gears 20 times and you can follow me. There's no evidence that any species other than humans does that. It's called recursion. And the whole syntax grammar that humans have in language, it doesn't seem to exist in any other species.
So you're looking, I mean, the genetic code that we share is what, 95, 99%? What is the number, John?
Well, that's one of the interesting things. There's a long propagated idea that we have a 1%, 1.2% difference between humans and chimpanzees. And indeed, that's true if you look at genes alone. But much of the genome, most of the genome, most of the DNA in us is not genes. It doesn't code for proteins and things like that. Most of it tells genes when to turn on and off. It's called the non-coding region. When you look at all the variation between us, it's about 5%.
5% difference. And in that difference, which you're focused on, you're finding just about, well, the key things that make us human.
Yeah, and there are lots of surprises. And there are some things that are completely logical. I mean, one of the biggest areas of difference between us is how our brains develop. And you can see that in the non-coding regions. It's very clear that more change has happened in the regions that tell the genes to make the brain or turn different genes on and off in the brains. And that's a fascinating insight that we didn't have before. And similarly, researchers have found a gene that's connected to language. It is not the language gene. There's no such thing. But there are a network of genes that allow us to have language, and researchers have found one that they're using as a fishing hook to pull out others, and maybe over time we will have a clear map of what allows us to use words so effectively.
It's really interesting. I mean, there was this tight, you know, almost human idea about chimps, and now you're saying, hey, wait a minute, we've got bigger, more complex brains, full-fledged language, writing, sophisticated tools, and you go, you know, control of fire, complex cultures. We walk upright, travel far and wide, and that's a big list. But you know, apart from the almost human thing, people are going to look at that and say, "Well, of course we're human; they're not."
That's right. And I just think the notion that we are almost chimpanzees kind of spins almost human on its head. I think we've overemphasized our similarities to the point when somebody is attacked by their pet chimpanzees, people are shocked. Well, of course a pet chimpanzee is a wild animal. What were you thinking? And I think we have to be much more realistic about how we see chimpanzees and how they see us. They don't look at us and say, hey, is that where I'm going? And every human looks at a chimpanzee from a very young age and says, whoa, I see something in myself there. Is that, am I from a common ancestor? And I'm just trying to push people to look more closely at those differences because I think they ultimately do tell us what it means to be human.
We're going to come back and look at those differences. You must have felt it, though, yourself when you're standing in front of a chimp and you look at them. It's happened to people time and again. You look into their eyes. It feels like, whoa, there's a cousin.
Absolutely. And it's a remarkable feeling to see chimpanzees in the wild and hang out with them because they are almost human. And at the same time, you know, let's not fool ourselves. There's this element of fear and they're wild animals, believe me.
John Cohen is with us. His new book is Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforests, Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. You were all over the world on this, John. What, Japan, Germany, all over the U.S., Africa?
Yeah, I tried to meet with all the leading researchers around the world, as many as I could. It's kind of a small community of people. And I was interested in following them and observing them doing their work, not simply sitting in their offices and chatting about things, but watching them work with apes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about chimps and humans and the argument that they are not almost human and that the difference has shaped, really, the world. John Cohen is with us from San Diego. His new book is Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforests, Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. John, we've got some wonderful feedback on the air. Here's Corey writes on our website, I don't know, I've seen chimps smoke cigars, ride bicycles, and drink beer. I think they have almost all the most important aspects of humanity covered. And here a poem written just for this show by our listener Robert Pierce. He says, written just for this program, the chimpanzee makes simple tools to trap termites and bite them, but we make tools to make more tools and so ad infinitum. Okay, I'll take it. I like it. Let's hear from our listeners. Yeah, John?
Well, one of the things that fascinated me from the outset of my project was chimpanzees don't swim. And that means they're bounded by rivers, and they live in very tight geographic areas. That has a huge influence on every bug pathogen they're going to see, the diet and the metabolism that evolves inside of their bodies. So their whole genetic makeup, it's constrained by this fact that they don't swim. Think about the fact that we go everywhere and what that means to humans.
Take us to the elements that made that possible. Why are we going everywhere? Not just swimming rivers, but flying all around. Why are we doing that and chimps not? Take us to the critical.
Sure. Well, that listener pointed to one thing that's very important, and that's that, as one researcher points out, we ratchet culture. We pass on culture from generation to generation, and things become more and more complex. In chimpanzee, we refer to culture as things that are socially transmitted, like fishing for termites. But any chimpanzee born today could learn to do that thing very quickly. Chimpanzees don't teach. There's no strong evidence that they teach. Think about what teaching means to humans, what a huge impact that has on our culture and how we behave.
So there's teaching. Why does that happen with us and not with chimps? Can you point to what it is about our brains, our communication skills that is the difference?
Well, there are lots of facets to it that are – the pieces are just being put together to this puzzle in many ways. One thing that's a stark difference between us and them is our brains develop much more slowly. So a chimpanzee by about the age of 2 years old – has a brain that's maybe 80% fully formed. The wiring's there. We get to about 90% growth at 10 years old. That means that we've spent 10 years or so socializing with people and wiring. So we are hyper-cooperative people, species. We're a hyper... Chimpanzees are cooperative to some degree. But they don't have as anywhere near as good of an understanding as we do as the wants and needs and intentions of others.
There's been so much attention to communication and what can be communicated by chimps and what cannot. Here's a little bit where you're speaking with William Fields. He's director of Bonobo Research at the Great Ape Trust outside Des Moines, Iowa. Let's just listen to your interaction.
They're listening. And they understand parts of life. They always understand everything.
Oh, they're listening to us right now?
Oh, I'm certain. They're very curious.
How can they hear us right now? Are they just on the other side of the wall right there?
They can't hear everything, but they hear certain things. And I try to make sure that I'm careful. You never know.
They're listening. He's careful. What did you come away from that with, John?
Well, there was a concrete block wall that separated us from the bonobos that lived in this enclosure, and he was concerned that they might hear our conversation. I think that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. That's just a rule of thumb in science. And when it comes to ape language research, that's been sort of the bugaboo of the field for many years, is that it's been very difficult to come up with the extraordinary proof. The researcher I was speaking with there was a very earnest person. He knows more about the field than I do. But I just had a hard time believing that they heard us through the concrete block wall and furthermore understood what we were talking about.
Let's get a call from Emily in Nashville, Tennessee. Emily, you're on the air with John Cohen.
Yes, hi. I have a question. I love the show, and I've also read Jane Goodall's work, seen Gorillas in the Mist, read Songs of a Gorilla Nation and Almost Human.
Yep.
And I'm very excited to read this new book. But my question is, in the book Songs of a Gorilla Nation, the author makes an assertion that there is a species of primate that is capable of some guttural human speech about on the level of a child. And I guess if that is true, then that definitely throws a few of my theories out of the water, and I just wanted to hear what the author had to say about that.
John?
People have tried for more than a century to get chimpanzees and other apes to vocalize in English. And it's kind of hilarious stuff because they end up flapping their lips and putting tongue depressors in their mouths to make these sounds. The fact of the matter is, that's not how they communicate. They make pant hoots and screams and grunts. And I find it almost absurd that humans have spent so much time getting apes to speak English, and very little effort has gone into really understanding the sounds that they naturally make to communicate with each other. And I went in the wild in Uganda and watched researchers who were trying to do this in an extremely methodical way, but it just hasn't happened very much. And there's been all this attention on this sort of Dr. Doolittle idea of talking to them.
Part of that maybe goes back to Jane Goodall's approach. You say she believed that a critical mass of humans would most likely come to her cause, that is, environmental conservation, if they imagined their own hands reaching for the curl of a chimpanzee's finger, that kind of connection.
Yeah, and I want to stress something. Jane Goodall has done great good. I mean, she's lived up to her last name.
Uh-huh.
Let's not at all shortchange Jane Goodall for what she's done. But I do think that at some point we have to be critical and skeptical about many of the overstated claims that people make about similarities to really understand what we are.
Let's go to Chris in Providence, Rhode Island. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a statement first, and it's about the 1% difference that's always been toted between us and the chimpanzees that your guest now says is 5%. The statement is, the people who think we're that close to chimpanzees haven't really given enough time into studying or at least opening up their information, where they get their information from, to know that that's a huge spectrum. And it's not just 1% as in, we can go and like somehow mate with them through species, but it's a huge spectrum, and it's not just 1% as in, really, really close.
And your question, Chris?
My question for your guest is whether there's any comparison between our ancestors at the caveman level when we first started developing speech and how we could communicate and how we developed into the humans we are now, and any comparison between them and the chimpanzees of today's world.
Thanks, Chris. John?
Yeah, I mean, on the first point, it's true. 1%, we're talking about 3.2 billion bases of DNA. That's a lot. 1%'s, you know, a lot. Mm-hmm. And 5%'s five times as much. Mm-hmm. In terms of humans and ancient archaic humans, yes, they and extant chimpanzees, we separated from a common ancestor 5 million years ago. But if you look at the cranial size of a chimpanzee today, the space that the brain fits in, it's about the same as those archaic humans. So it's not to say that the chimpanzee we see today is that animal that existed 5 million years ago, but I do think that we have evolved much more rapidly in many, many facets than they have, and particularly in the brain.
You write about hybrids here. What do you mean by that, and what did you learn?
Well, when you compare the human and chimpanzee genome, one of the interesting things that popped out, and this is controversial, not everybody agrees with it, but very prominent researchers published this in the journal Nature, that humans separated from a common ancestor with chimpanzees and then mated with chimpanzees again, and a humanzee, or whatever you want to call it, knuckle-dragged and walked the earth for thousands of years before the species once again separated completely.
And how long ago? Is there a time frame around that?
Well, millions of years ago.
Okay.
I don't think that they could put a more precise time frame on it than that. But if you look at other species, look at horses and donkeys that make a mule. There are hybrids in nature all the time, and I have a chapter that looks at different hybrids, some of which have just shown up recently because we're able to analyze DNA now in a way that we couldn't in the past. So the Pizzly is a grizzly bear and a polar bear that was shot by a hunter in the wild a few years back. Nobody had ever seen a Pizzly in the wild, but they exist.
Are you suggesting that some humans today are descended from hybrid and some are descended from another line in the
I'm not suggesting it. It's been published in Nature, and the researchers make us, I think, a very compelling case that we're all descendants of this hybrid. That's what we are. And remember, you know, the humans that are alive today were one of many species of humans. All the other ones died out, the Neanderthals and all these other archaic species, the fossil Lucy that people spend a lot of time studying. Those don't exist as far as we know.
Let's go to Jim in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Jim, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, for taking my question. Yeah. Always amazed at the variety of topics on the show. A great show.
Thank you.
My question is, I think you guys were alluding to it earlier, is man the only animal that lives historically? Is that one of the major differences?
With a sense of history, you mean, Jim?
Yes. In other words, you know, if you shoot a deer and the other deer standing beside it, it doesn't remember 5 months from now not to go back to that spot. In other words, humans have a passed down history and a memory of past events that you know, makes them different from animals. Is that fair to say?
Thank you, Jim. What do you say, John?
I think there's abundant evidence that other species understand the past and can return to sites and that they've been in. What I think distinguishes humans is we pass it on from generation to generation.
And that cannot be done? That's got to be a genetic difference, right? I mean, that's not behavioral, what gets passed
well,
down.
Well, we have an oral tradition where we tell each other things from the past. And we also have writing and artwork that no other species we know of writes on cave walls that, you know, that hasn't been seen. And certainly no other species we know of writes books or has the internet.
Yeah, one more, and from Virginia Beach, Monica. Monica, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Just really just a comment just about the everyone's interest. I mean, even as a child, I remember seeing the Planet of the Apes science fiction series and was enthralled and, you know, just where they were trying to point out differences or similarities. And even in that series show that there was a hierarchy even amongst the apes, you know, the scholarly orangutans, et cetera. I just was enthralled. I think it's a very good topic. Thank you.
Yeah, Monica, everybody wants to see this Planet of the Apes. Monica, thank you for your call. John, what about it? Another piece of popular culture that goes to that connection.
Yeah, I think there's a strong desire for humans to communicate with other species and to see our origin more clearly. I mean, I think the basis of all religion is to understand our origins. So I think all this pop culture and all this literature that goes back really centuries looking at the human-ape relationship as so very close is in part our wanting to understand where we come from and who we are. And it goes overboard in things like Planet of the Apes, because that's the logical sort of dream that many people have, that we really can communicate. And, you know, it would be like talking to aliens from another planet. It's that same desire.
Here's a question from the web. It says, I'm curious about your guest's claim that chimps don't teach. I recall reading an article where scientists working with chimps teaching them sign language noticed that the offspring of a chimp mother had been taught sign language by the mother and used it with her and with one another to communicate. Was this not true, asks Jason.
Well, there's a researcher in Atlanta at Emory University in Yerkes, Franz Duval, who calls it the sushi master form of learning. Chimps certainly learn, but the abundance of evidence, the bulk of evidence suggests that they learn by observation, and it's not teaching per se.
I'm not sure I know the difference.
Well, when you learn to cut sushi, you don't receive instruction. You sit and watch somebody cut sushi for 2 years or 3 years. And the sushi master is your teacher, quote unquote, but isn't teaching you. You're observing. The difference in teaching is it comes at some cost to the teacher. There's some goal involved, and there's reward and punishment. Not just watching. And nut cracking in chimpanzees has been the key thing that researchers have looked at to see if wild chimpanzees do teach each other. And there is a little there's one report of a few instances of a mother helping an offspring crack a nut. But there's one site in Guinea-Bissau that has videotaped for 20 years chimpanzees with nuts and stones cracking them open and has not observed a single instance of a mother teaching the offspring how to do it.
Ed in Concord, North Carolina. You're on the air, Ed.
Hi, guys. Hey, I love the program. I'm a volunteer at our zoo here. I've been volunteering with the chimps for 10 years now. I'd like to point out Richard Dawkins, former professor of zoology, says that bone for bone, muscle for muscle, tooth for tooth, there's no difference between a human and a chimp. That of all of the species on Earth, humans and chimps are the most closely related. And in fact, a human and a chimp can have a blood transfusion if they have the right groups. Chimps share the ABO blood groups with us, which when I first heard of it, found startling. I think the differences between us have been so exaggerated for thousands and thousands of years that maybe it's time for the pendulum to swing just a little bit the other way, and we might find that the differences aren't so much of kind, but of degree.
So keep the link going, you say, Ed. Let me hold that for just a second because I don't have time. I'm going to let you go, John, but we've got others calling in and saying, you know, they're concerned your argument may be used to justify cruelty to chimpanzees and other apes, that if we focus too much on differences, we think they don't matter.
No, absolutely not. I don't think that we should protect species simply because they are similar to us. I mean, should we protect elephants? Of course we should. And I am not at all advocating cruelty to chimps. Quite the opposite. I think that one of the major differences between us is that we determine their fate and they don't determine ours. And we've been very terrible stewards.
And with this, are you worried at all that people will say, well, you know, we're different. They're behind us. We're moving on. Good luck to them. I mean, you're right that we may soon see chimps not in the wild anymore, only directly in the hands of humans in captivity.
Sure, I'm worried about that, and I'm worried that people will take what I'm arguing to bolster things like creationism, which I think are nonsense as well. If you read the book, you'll see that I very carefully dismiss those arguments, and I hope very forcefully point out the importance of conservation and the importance of evolution.
John Cohen's new book is Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforests, Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. He's a correspondent for Science Magazine, been with us from San Diego today. It's been really interesting. John, thank you very much for being with us here.
Thanks so much. It's been a great pleasure.
When we come back, we'll talk with novelist Sarah Gruen. She wrote Water for Elephants, was a big, big book. Now she's out with a new one. It's called Ape House. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sarah Gruen was a laid-off technical writer when she tried fiction writing. She wrote Riding Lessons and Flying Changes. Then her third book, Water for Elephants, became a number one New York Times bestseller. A star-studded movie based on the book is coming out next April. Her new novel is Ape House, much of it based on her time at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines, Iowa. Sarah Gruen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Elephants, and now apes. What is it with you and animals?
I just love them. I surround myself in real life with animals, and since I tend to spend 5 to 8 hours a day in my fictional world, they just sort of pop up.
Your personal story grabs an awful lot of people, you know, slaving away at whatever it may have been, in your case, technical writing. And then the first thing we hear about you, you've got a great big bestseller out in the world. How do you look at that story yourself now? What made that happen?
I'm still sort of poking myself on the shoulder and seeing if it's real. I was actually quite a happy technical writer. I was doing metadata modeling and working for statistical software companies. And I know that sounds as about as juicy as a saltine to a lot of people, but it was fun, and I was quite happy doing it until I got laid off, and that basically took the shine off it.
Water for Elephants was your third novel. What happened to the first two?
Well, the first one met some acclaim, and by that I mean that nobody actually cared what I was doing for the next year and a half, and what I was doing was writing Water for Elephants, and so it was a very different kind of book, and I don't think at the time people, meaning publishers, knew what it was or what to do with it, and so my editor at the time passed on it and asked me if I would instead write a sequel to Riding Lessons. So I wrote Flying Changes. And they came out in the opposite order. Flying Changes came out first, and then Water for Elephants came out. But it was a very slow burn. It didn't just fly off up the charts immediately. And so I don't think there was ever a real moment of recognition that it was okay, that it was really okay. I was going to get to keep writing books.
What do you, and ultimately it was all over the bestseller list, and there it is, you know, on Oprah, and you're way up in the stratosphere. What do you think it was about this story, Water for Elephants, of love and elephants and circus and what time and age that caught people?
I just, you know, if I knew that, I would just write a book like that every time. And I think everybody would. It's, to some extent, I feel like I was struck by lightning. I think there are a lot of really, really good books out there that just don't get discovered. And for some reason that I don't really know why, I'm very grateful. But I was picked up by many book clubs, and word of mouth and booksellers were hand-selling it, and so I had a lot of things that kind of came together and aligned and made this happen.
Sarah Gruen, nobody's ignoring you now. I mean, you had a big publisher come in and swoop down $5 million contract to write the next two books. Boy, talk about the pressure on. What was that like? They put big money down on you, and you know what they want for that. They want big hits. It must be something else to write under that pressure.
There's a fair bit of pressure involved. But, you know, I want the big hit, too. I wanted to write something very different than Water for Elephants, although I do explore many of the same themes, most notably what constitutes a family, can you choose your family, and I look at the dysfunction, and also things like if you've had... if you look up your family tree and you don't like what you see there, why would you go in and reproduce yourself? And really about the way humans treat humans.
How did you get onto this? You've got bonobo apes that end up on a sort of crazed reality TV show in the new book, Ape House. How did you come onto this theme, Sarah?
Well, I've always been fascinated in human language, or human ape discourse, and I have been following the story of Coco the gorilla since 1980. And in fact, I wanted to go into this field and asked Francine Patterson, who's Coco's person, what courses I would need to take to do this. And well, unfortunately, one of them was biology, and when I hit high school, it became very clear I couldn't dissect so much as a worm, and so that went out the window, and I turned to literature instead. But when I discovered, I had never heard of bonobo apes until 4 years ago, and then I discovered that they were there in Des Moines, and that they were using lexigram boards to communicate with humans, and I was just fascinated. And one of the great things about this job is that if I get a great passion for something, I can just go off and follow it for a few years and set a book, make a book about it. And so the bonobos are very amorous creatures. They use sexual contact as a means of reaffirming friendship and dispelling tension. And captive bonobos, I believe, initiate some kind of sexual contact every hour and a half.
So it's really going on.
And in every absolute every variation, they're virtuosic. And so I did that sort of naturally led to a TV show, a reality TV show, which could best be described as the ape version of Jersey Shore.
They are sort of taken off by a notorious pornographer who makes this, Ain't That America, makes them the stars of a reality TV show where there are subtitles of their signing that's going on, I guess.
Yeah. And then so there's the element of armchair scientists who pretend that they're watching because they're interested in the language when, of course, they're looking at the sex. And one of the things that goes wrong on the reality TV show is that the bonobos do not end up acting like humans, and the producers get increasingly desperate to make them form alliances and do the things that happen when you throw people into a house together and lock them in. And so he has increasingly desperate interventions to try to make some of these things happen, and of course it just doesn't.
Humans imposing humanness on chimps. Callers, Susan in Clinton, Massachusetts, you're on with Sarah Gruen.
Hello. Thank you. I was just answering what you had spoken of earlier, why Water for Elephants appealed to people, and I loved that book. I'm so excited to be able to talk to you, Sarah. It was just a great book. And two reasons, for me personally, two reasons that I was brought the book was I had spent time with elephants in Thailand, and before I did that, I had no idea how intelligent they really are, and was so impressed with how intelligent they were. And so somebody brought the book to me because of that experience that I had. But you brought that out in your book, and you had such unexpected characters. And I don't want to say anything about the book for people who haven't read it, but it just had a real whimsy and unexpected sort of unexpected results, but tapping into people's childish kind of dreams. And that's what I found really appealing about it. Thank you.
Susan, thank you. You tapped in deep, obviously. People really went for it. You thought a lot about elephants there and now about bonobos, apes. I don't know. If these were two friends of yours, these two species, how would you describe them?
Well, one of them is a friend of mine. So I keep in touch with the bonobos at the Great Ape Trust. And in fact, my last visit was about a week ago, and as I left, Pam Benicia asked me if I would send her another potato head, Mr. Potato Head, because that was one of the first gifts I brought her.
Okay. Great. So you looked at elephants, then you looked at bonobos. I don't know. Where do you choose if you have to choose a friend here?
Neither one of them belongs in my home, but I'll happily go and visit either one of them.
You've got a piece right in the front of the book, Ape House. If you start with, it's funny, actually, back-to-back quotes. And one is from an ape, Nim Chimpsky, in the 1970s here, who was quoted by the scientists observing Nim at Columbia University saying, "Give orange, give me, eat orange, me, eat orange, give me, eat orange, give me, you." And then right below it, you quote lines from a song by Britney Spears where she simply says, give me more, give me more, give me more. You're making the point there that we got a lot in common across these lines.
Well, and I'm also making a statement about human culture at this particular moment in time and some of the tabloidiness.
But at the same time, so there is that. It's obvious and it's fun to look at. But of course, you also know Nim Chimpsky. There was all kinds of controversy about how credible that research was. And you heard us just talking with John Cohen, who's coming in and saying, look, let's pay attention to the differences. Let's not overblow the communication abilities of apes. Let's be careful here. I mean, where are you in the realm of science or fiction?
Well, Nim Chimpsky, I don't think he really had a chance because he had rotating teachers, as they called them. And he was actually sat down at a desk every day for his lessons, and when he was bad, he was put into a box. And that's not the way that we teach human children language either. And so what I have been most fascinated with about what the work going on at Great Ape Trust is that they are exposing the apes as infants in the same way that we expose our own infants to language, and just speaking to them all the time and using these lexigram boards And they acquire language as opposed to being taught it. And
what's a lexigram board, sir?
Oh, it's a pictorial. A lexigram is a pictorial representation of a word. And they have, I think, 400, or very close to it, 400 lexigrams on their board. And it's a really complicated board. I tried to learn my way around it before I got out there, and it was kind of like a French immersion class. It wasn't until I got out there and was actually having to use it that my fingers learned some of the locations of these things. But the apes are, and it, for me, that seemed like kind of a duh moment, because we have a window of opportunity to learn language ourselves, and that may very well be different in apes, but I think that the window exists.
Great Ape Trust in Des Moines, Iowa, endowed there by a big, like a hot dog fortune. John Cohen, pretty skeptical about some of the work there, though the people there are obviously very enthusiastic about it. Does it matter to you how much we're reading into these communications and how much is scientifically factual? Does it work just as well for you as a fiction writer either way?
Well, you know, I'm not a scientist, so I can only speak to my own experience, but you know, my first, and I don't know how often John visited with Pambinesia. I know that our conversations were very short and limited on the first visit, but by the seventh visit, Pambinesia was downright chatty with me.
Jan is calling from Somerville, South Carolina. Jan, you're on the air.
Thank you. Sarah, I just want to tell you that Water for Elephants is one of the most nourishing books I think I've ever read. And I walk with a group of retired school teachers, and we kind of pass books around, and it was passed to me, and that was 2 years ago. I'm ready to read it again. It's just the most fantastic book, and I can't wait to read your new book about the monkeys.
Jen, when you say it was nourishing, what do you mean by that?
I don't know. It just felt so good, and I loved the ending. It was just a wonderful experience. It's one of those books that stands out in your mind, and you say, "Yeah, I'll read that book again." So anyway, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you,
Jen. Thanks for your call. Thank you very much. Did you set out to nourish, Sarah Grun?
I set out to try to tell a really good story, and I write very organically, so in fact I didn't really know where I was going with it until I sort of got there. And I wrote, just as an interesting factoid, I wrote about a third of that book in a walk-in closet because I just needed to be in a sensory deprivation pod.
Wow, a walk-in closet to seal everything else out and just be there.
Yeah, and at the time I didn't have wireless, so now it wouldn't work, or I'd have to rip the wireless card out of my laptop. But my theory was that if I went in there with my file and just opened my file and stared at it long enough, something would happen, and I staggered forth into the light 3.5 months later with a finished manuscript.
Wow, I know how that can go. Now you've got big publisher money writing on the whole process. Just shop talk-wise, how does that work? Did they sit down with you and say, all right, let's sort out what it was about Water for Elephants that made it such a big hit, and now here, Sarah, here's the DNA we want you to take into this next book. Was there that kind of conversation?
No, I had the concept for the book, and it was, you know, the publisher who felt the passion for it that I went to. It really was, it's not kind of dissection, and certainly I did not write Water for Elephants again, and I did that on purpose because I can't write Water for Elephants again, and I would like to be able to spread my wings as a writer and be able to write things that are different and perhaps have my readers even expect that from me and know that I'm going to bring my very best to the table every time.
There was a lot of very magnetic sentiment in Water for Elephants. Is that the big theme again this time, or a big thread through the book, or I see a lot of humor in this book, Ape House.
Yeah, I certainly had a lot of fun writing it, and it was there's enough sort of tabloid culture and stuff going on in the current day that is just setting itself up to be made fun of.
And how do you end up thinking about apes? You spend time with them, you make them big characters in your book, whatever their powers of communication, you got close to them. They seem to mean a lot to you. How do you think about them in the whole universe of creatures?
Well, they're endangered, and they certainly need our help to survive. And my particular take on it is that our best hope for saving chimpanzees or bonobos or gorillas is to save their habitats and that have them live there. And that's so conservation efforts, I think, is really in, you know, for these particular apes at the trust. I will continue to go back and visit them probably forever, but I work, I don't work with, that's a silly word, but I support and am in contact with the Lola Ya Bonobo Sanctuary in the Congo, which takes the babies that have been orphaned from the bushmeat trade and brings them up and then re-releases them into the jungle where they belong.
Sarah Gruen, her new book is Ape House. She wrote Water for Elephants. It was huge. It'll be out as a movie next April. Big bestseller. Now Ape House is out. And your next, are you already on to it, Sarah?
I'm on tour, yes.
But your next book, have you, is that already begun? Are you in the walk-in closet pounding out another?
Well, I can't do it when I'm on tour because I'm just, you know, my brain turns to mush and I'm traveling all the time. But it's certainly percolating. I have the idea, and as soon as I get off the road, I'll go back into the walk-in closet.
Novelist Sarah Gruen joined us today from Atlanta, Georgia. Her new book is Ape House. You may have read Water for Elephants. Sarah Gruen, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And here's that Britney Spears with Gimme More, Gimme, Gimme More. Sarah compares it to Ape Talk. Well, listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.